Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. It has been a while, and your hosts are here back again online. This is Stefan Sasse. I am a contributor to the Tower of the Hand. I have my own blog for all things nerd at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com. And with me is, as always,
Sean T. Collins. I am the creator and humble host of All Leather Must Be Boiled and A Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones blog located at boiledleather.com. I cover Game of Thrones for Rolling Stone, and I am the co-author of the official annotated A Game of Thrones with Elio Garcia Jr. from Westeros.org and Anne Grohl, the editor of the series.
And we both read this new Winds of Winter chapter as if we could not, and we are going to talk about it today. And just to lay out for you the groundwork of this episode, we found out that there are two main topics we want to attack in this podcast. And one is the political situation in Meereen and battle strategy and all that kind of good stuff. And on the other side, the character development of Tyrion, because we get some glimpses into how the events of A Dance with Dragons have shaped him and how he is now in his current state of affairs.
And I guess we'll start with the politics or the strategy, the whatever you would call it, because it's a Tyrion chapter that takes place while the Battle of Fire, as it were, although there's not a whole lot of fire yet, the battle outside the walls of Meereen between the united forces of Slaver's Bay and sort of in the middle, and then on one side Barristan Selmy and his Unsullied and assorted other forces, and on the other side all of a sudden Victarion Greyjoy and the Ironborn. This is now all underway, and so through Tyrion and his camp at the second with the Second Sons, you get a picture of what's going on, of how things are faring for the various forces, of what the important objectives of the battle are right now. And, you know, and specifically that involves the Yunkish want to preserve their enormous trebuchets, is it? The Wicked
yeah.
Sister and the... Yeah. And they also want to repel the Ironborn landing. What emerges for me here... It's just how fucking dire the situation is for the Yunkish forces and their allies. Because they're really caught between two of the most fearsome fighting forces in the entire world, led by two very experienced and capable leaders, generals, warlords, whatever you want to call them. And by contrast, they are a collection of slave soldiers ordered into battle by people who are referred to by the Second Sons, you know, as a series of, like, different insulting joke names, Pudding Face, and, you know, none of these people really inspire any great loyalty or a sense that they actually even know what they're doing. And, you know, and they're backed up by sellsword companies of dubious loyalty, actually no loyalty, as it turns out. The Windblown turn their cloaks, and by the end of the chapter, the Second Sons turn their cloak, return their cloaks. So they really don't, you know, Tyrion is quite right to sense that, like, the time has come to get on the winning side, and the Slaver's Bay people are not the winning side right now.
Yeah, exactly. I was amazed at just how quickly the seemingly totally superior position of the Yunkish gets turned, and they are in a very losing situation right now. I mean, they lost two catapults already by the start of the chapter. Their armies are in total disorganization while the Unsullied are marching on and defeating them chop by chop. The Ironborn have landed and are securing this beachhead, and things are really turning sour. The Windblown already attacking, and the dragons in the sky, let's not forget them. So the situation has turned really, really quick. And I think the commanders of the Yunkish are the interesting part in it, because without the plague that we had, I forgot how it's called, a Pale Mare, was it? Without this plague, they would still have something resembling a unified command. But right now, they have this changing command structure. Every day, someone else is in charge, which basically guarantees total chaos in all administrative structures. And it was mocked with this "we have flowcharts" thing that was drawn up at the end of A Dance with Dragons, and this is obviously now falling on their heads because there is no one responsible. People are giving orders to that no one is acting out because there is no accountability to anything. There is this writer coming into the camp of the Second Sons, and he's telling them that the current commander orders them to do something, protect. It is obviously a silly order, protect a catapult with light infantry, light cavalry. And they simply refuse him because what is he going to do? There is no chance to change anything. And so without a command structure that can take some heat, that you can really stress in such a situation, you are going down. And on the other hand, we have Dany's army or Barristan's army, obviously reacting very quick to the changing circumstances. I mean, nobody had the Ironborn on their radar, and now they're landing. And Dany's forces are reacting to it very quickly, while the others obviously aren't.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's obviously a great deal of uncertainty about the future. You know, when Barristan's forces reach Victarion's forces, what happens then? Particularly when Victarion starts blowing his horn and tries to make his play for the dragons, and then, you know, he finds out Daenerys isn't there. I don't think he knows that yet. She may, by that point, have returned. There's still a lot we don't know about how this will play out. I very much doubt it winds up with, like, Victarion just getting on board and joining forces and becoming part of Daenerys' small council or whatever. You know, the fucking Grey Worm. For now, Barristan's calculated risk of opening the gates and attacking just so happens to work out great for him, because all of a sudden there's this other force attacking from the other side. And they can, you know, it's a hammer and an anvil. So it works out very well for them. And then I think, you know, as you point out, the lack of command structure for the forces of Slaver's Bay is a complete disaster. It's great if you're effectively recreating a Slaver's Bay society in the camps outside of Meereen, which is what they had done for the siege. You know, all these people living in Splendor, you know, but for the Pale Mare, all these lords and masters would have lived in Splendor, and their slaves would have done this and that, and everything works out great, and they've got slave markets out there, and they're having a grand old time while people in Meereen, you know, must endure the siege. But the moment you have to mobilize that, it just doesn't work at all. It would be like all of a sudden telling, you know, if they were still sitting in Yunkai, and they're like, okay, everybody, fight! Right? You know, there's really nothing to be done about it. With regards to the sellsword companies, you know, I think what surprised me here was the nakedness of the betrayal. You know, I mean, it seems that Tyrion and Jorah and Brown Ben Plum are all basically counting on their help being so appreciated and the victors being so pleased with having won that the obvious bullshit that they're selling about how this was the plan all along. I defected so that I could be a mole within their ranks and then turn on them when they needed me the most. You know, they're just hope. I don't know if they're expecting, but their whole plan basically counts on a grateful Daenerys and Barristan being like, okay, yeah, sure, no problem. Which is tough to believe will happen. But, I don't really have much of a choice if they want to win, which they do.
Yeah, I think what they are pretty much counting on is a sense of pragmatism in Daenerys' camp, which, given the nature of Dany's last chapter in Dance with Dragons, isn't something I would count on. But they can't know that, of course. So, I mean, what does a victorious Dany want to do? Slaughter two sellsword companies in front of all the others? Just start a second war now that you won the old. I guess that is more or less the line of thought that's at play here. You know, just going for the cockiness of it and hope that the other one will accept it because the alternative is just so stupid.
Yeah, I suppose what surprised me specifically is Jorah's willingness to get fully on board with this plan and, you know, swear on all that is holy and you know, all his Mormont ancestors, every bear he can fucking find on Bear Island, that this was the plan all along. Like, Jorah, because you're only really seeing him through Tyrion's eyes, you don't necessarily get a sense of this unless you kind of sit and think about it, but man, that guy has been through some shit. And is in very desperate straits. You know, I mean, he was worse off than Tyrion as a slave because he was beaten.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's to say nothing of having been turned out by the woman he loves. And
he got this tattoo on his cheek.
Yeah, and I'm sure actually feeling quite guilty about the fact that he was betraying Dany. I mean, that's another thing. You know, that was real. I mean, she was angry at him. He did what she was angry at him for doing.
But I guess it is reasonable what he does because when he swears that Brown Ben Plum really did this all along, the unspoken thing here is that Brown Ben Plum will support him also. And I guess if he swears that, Brown Ben Plum will attribute a great deal of the success of all of this to Jorah, you know, like he devised all the battle plans or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, and as Tyrion said, Jorah rose in the ranks very quickly. You know, I mean, he obviously has this relationship with Brown Ben Plum, but that could work against him as much as it works in his favor, obviously. But Tyrion says he was surprised when he walked into the command tent to find Ser Jorah there.
Yeah.
But, you know, whether that's because Brown Ben sees him as a person of value because of, you know, like Brown Ben, he used to be on Dany's small council, or whether it's because they just naturally respect his prowess and his knowledge of the situation, you know, a convincing case can certainly be made that he played a key role in the strategy. You know,
I mean, he conquered Meereen once, so I guess you want him at your side.
Yeah, for sure. And I was surprised, you know, it was funny when I was reading. You have this moment where this liaison from the slavers is demanding that Tyrion be restored to slavery. And Jorah's like, oh, here's what I think of that idea, and kills the guy. And I'm like, whoa, Jorah killing slavers and fighting for Tyrion, wow. And then I was like, well, wait a minute, he's not just fighting for Tyrion, he's fighting for himself, because he was a slave as well. So he's just fucking had it at this point. And, you know, it's kind of, I guess we have to watch when we start getting too excited about catharsis through murder, but, I was excited to see that happen because it was just sort of nice to see Jorah have this decisive moment in favor of, like, you know, acting sort of heroically on behalf of the characters whom we know. Or whom we assume, you know, make matter in the end. So that was kind of
it. Nice. Yeah, he also forces Brown Bin Plum's hand at this point. He kills the messenger, which settles the discussion about whether the second son's a defect or not. So you shouldn't underestimate this one. Politics through the sword is pretty much something that many characters in A Song of Ice and Fire are accustomed to. I mean, just think of the Dornish. They are experts in this. Just kill the right person and politics are going your way.
Right, yeah, and that's an excellent point and one I had forgotten. But yeah, that ends that particular debate. Although no one seems all that upset about it.
The decision was more or less made. He just, I don't know, fixes it. So no one can go back from this point. There is no churning cloak again or saying, oh no, it was just a misunderstanding because, I mean, they killed the messenger in the content. So that's Jorah just playing it a bit shrewd.
Yeah. Although I do wonder how Jorah ever really... Is there a redemption arc for Jorah Head in terms of him sort of restoring his honor? Because, you know, at this point you're killing messengers. And you're helping sellswords lie to your queen.
Yeah, I mean, Jorah doesn't even want redemption. As far as I see it, he still doesn't see any wrong in his decision to sell the poachers. He still feels that he is innocently being convicted by Eddard Stark, and his subsequent spying, for that he wants forgiveness by Dany, and he thinks he can achieve it by giving her something she wants.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that ultimately he just sort of wants the opportunity to fight and die for Dany. More fight than die, but if he has to die, okay, fine, sure. The other thing I wanted to touch on here, I hope this isn't too much of a left turn, but just the opening of this chapter and a lot of what Tyrion subsequently says to Penny about battle and thinks to himself about battle, I think it's one of the most vivid and disturbing and almost sort of darkly comic depictions of warfare that Martin has offered yet in a series that's obviously done a whole lot. It's almost like Guernica. And maybe it's just because of the screaming about horses that opens the chapter and the prominence of horse heads in Guernica that made me think of it, but you just have this picture of total carnage and chaos, and it's bizarre and almost carnivalesque. You know, you have the Ironborn, and you can hear their war horns and the high whistles of Karth, and all these sounds and the screams of wounded men. You have catapults launching corpses through the air. You have dragons sweeping down to burn and eat the corpses in midair. You have all these motley, you know, you have the fighting forces of half a dozen different cultures, you know, all of whom look very weird in their own way, you know. Just imagine Victarion in his Kraken helm fighting, you know, a Giskari, you know, with his hair done up into like a, you know, a garden of roses or whatever. It's just a fascinatingly and vividly ugly portrait of battle. It's like Apocalypse Now, sort of. And
I know what you're getting at.
Yeah, yeah. And I also think that just Tyrion as a character who Martin has said he relates to perhaps the most. He's so unequivocal about what a terrible idea it is to involve yourself in war that I think we as readers should take that to heart. Anyway, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, this description of the battle and his memories that overwhelm him in this sequence are very much pointing toward a traumatizing effect of battle.
Yes.
He explicitly says that while it is a suspenseful event before it starts. He recalls the Battle of the Green Fork, how the army of his father is opening up like a flower or something, you know, all the beauty of it, how it looks from afar. And he specifically mentions how splendid his father looked on his horse, and that his father never came within 100 yards or whatever the measurement was of the actual battle. So this leading from behind, this being detached from the visceral horrors of the battle itself. And he, on the other hand, knows just how horrible battle is, and he really doesn't want to go into it, and he is in no particular rush to do so.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the statement really is pretty clear. And I also very much liked this recollection of his two previous battles, you know, the Green Fork being his first battle, just how actively he remembers it. I mean, that was back in the Game of Thrones. It is a lifetime away, you know, 1996.
Right.
and then the Battle of the Blackwater, which he says he doesn't remember much about, which is interesting, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And now this new battle, which he more or less intends to sit out. I think you can say that there is a anti-war message in there.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me that the memories of the battles are sort of conflated with this very intense, overwhelming memory of his murder of Shay.
Yes.
And how he suddenly, you know, I almost don't even know what's going on here. You know, I think it's part of it is just his terror about getting involved in battle and, like, and yeah, trauma, PTSD about his battle experiences. I also think he's an alcoholic who's going through withdrawal. But, you know, he careens from feeling as empathetic towards Penny as we've seen him seen, as we've seen him act, to, you know, being inches away from murdering her.
Yeah,
you know,
Tyrion is in a really dark place. It was just this what the fuck moment when I read this chapter, when he really is only inches away from murdering Penny, just because his memories are overwhelming him here. So we can definitely see that the events of A Storm of Swords and of A Dance with Dragons have left a clearly visible mark on Tyrion's psyche.
Yeah, and I sort of feel like this is a turning point for him, because the thing that stops him from potentially murdering Penny are the dragons. You know, it says he heard the shouts. He was lost in a black rage, drowning in a sea of memory, but then the shouting brought the world back in a rush. He opened his hands, took a breath, turned away from Penny. Something's happening. He went outside to discover what it was. Dragons. I like to think that is some kind of significant and symbolic turning point for him. And that perhaps,
Targaryen after all.
You know, the coming within inches of murdering Penny just for saying the wrong thing. And, you know, it's not that I think Tyrion can be redeemed from murdering Shay. Although I would point out that that's the kind of thing that people are murdered for in this world. You know, betrayals. There is that kind of code of justice. So it's not, you know, I'm very curious to see how the show, you know, to have a little tangent about the show, I'm very curious to see how the show portrays all this stuff, because Shay seems like a much more serious character on the show, and their relationship seems a lot more sincere and legitimate. You know, Shay isn't like a giggly little girl on the show. So, you know, I think, provided they go in the same direction, and which I don't see why they wouldn't, and Tyrion winds up killing Shay, I think it's going to feel very different than it does in the books. But,
yeah.
You know, clearly doing that broke something inside of him, and you know, maybe this is where the pieces start getting put back together. I don't know. But Penny seems Penny seems very, very, very crucial to that development.
Yeah, many people have asked themselves, what is the point of Penny as a character?
Mm-hmm.
And I think this chapter begins to give us a glimpse of why Martin introduced her.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that it really is a crucial cornerstone.
Well, surely Tyrion sees in Penny what his life might have been like were he not a Lannister. You know, and had he not been, you know, just left out in the woods to die as an infant. And, you know, I do like that kind of writing where a character sort of serves as a stand-in for an existing character, a double, a version of the character that allows the writer and even the original character to sort of explore aspects of themselves that otherwise don't come to the fore. And, you know, I think Penny's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
In her own right. You know, you don't get a lot of prominent small folk in the series. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, there's really not. I mean, there's the wildlings. There's Gendry. You know, is there anyone else? Shay, and Penny, and you know, Penny's the only one who doesn't kill or fuck for a living. in terms of the prominent wildlings, right? The prominent small folk. So. I've never really understood the Penny hate. I think she's an interesting character, and you know, even if you don't, I think here, as you say, you start to see why she might have been introduced in terms of her impact on Tyrion.
Yeah, I guess the Penny hatred is more or less a fallout from a general hatred for Tyrion's storyline in A Dance with Dragons.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not so much about her. His storyline for many people felt a bit overdrawn and superfluous, and so in extension was Penny.
Right. Well, then one thing I would say about this is that this chapter is a lot of fun, which is a weird thing to say when we've just gotten finished talking about how it depicts the horrors of war, and compared it to fucking Guernica, and you know how he almost murders Penny, and he's having these flashbacks to murdering Shay, and I'm like, but it's so much fun. But it is. It's a fun chapter. You know, it's got that sort of Tales of the Black Company feel. You know, these down and dirty dudes, like, just betraying people, murdering people, fucking shit up. There's dragons, there's Ironborn, there's corpses flying through the air, which, you know, this stuff is exciting in its way. There's neat little references to things that are going on. You know, he talks about, like, I wonder if Cersei tried to kill Bronn. I bet she would find that more difficult than she thought. You know, it's like, yep, you got that right. So I think if people found Tyrion's storyline during Dance to be a drag, I don't think they'll have to worry about that much longer. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, that's just one thing. When you said the chapter was fun, we also get much of the old Tyrion back in it. He is wisecracking all the time. These one-liners are back, you know, for which he and, of course, Peter Dinklage are so much loved for. He explains stuff from a position of superior intellect to us, as when he devises a battle strategy in his head, how to defeat the Unsullied, and all that stuff. You know, that is what many people, always, me included, always liked about Tyrion and his chapters. He's normally just smarter than everyone around him. And he was just more drunk than everyone around him. So now he's more or less back to his old form, just a little bit darker. And he's a dark imp. And now we see where that is going.
Yeah. Yeah. It was good fun. I mean, I remember tweeting after I finished reading. I was like, wow, this is a blast. And It's a glimpse of the, you sort of see, in a single chapter, you see the new Tyrion, the dark Tyrion, the drunk Tyrion, the bitter Tyrion, reach his absolute lowest point. And you also see, yeah, as you say, the glimpses of the old, clever, smart, wisecracking, smartest guy in the room, Tyrion, who everybody sort of fell in love with, rear his ugly little head again. And, you know, and that makes it, you know, it's just fun, his, you know, the interplay between him and the other commanders of the Second Sons, as they, like, mock these messengers to their face. It's, you know, and Tyrion doesn't even belong in there. You know, he says, people are used to seeing him play Sivas in there, or Sivas, however you want to pronounce it. So,
Sivas.
You know, so they just let, you know, but they leave him in there because I think they find him entertaining and smart, which he is. So he's both of those things. And it's fun to see that element come back. And, yeah. You know, I think if there's one thing that all of the Winds of Winter excerpts and sample chapters that we've seen share, it's that sense that they point to fun, exciting times ahead. Would you say that's fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. I don't know if I would choose these words, but I know what you mean, and I'm definitely agreeing with you. Which leads me to my next question: do you think Martin should have left these chapters in A Dance with Dragons?
I mean,
Dance with Dragons got so much heat about not being really resolved, about being a dragon, everything. And now we read these first chapters, which we know were intended to be in A Dance with Dragons. Right. And they're such a blast, and they are so interesting, and they get us so engaged. And do you think it would have been a better choice?
Well, I guess I would say three things, sort of all in a row. The first thing is, yes, obviously Dance would have been a better, more satisfying, more fun read if the storylines had the climaxes that were intended for them all along, which we're starting to see in these first few chapters. The second thing is that I understand why that decision was made, because this just... You know, how many sample chapters have we seen so far? Five?
Four or five.
And there's other ones that have been read out loud at appearances that we haven't... We only cover the ones that are actually released in print in some way. So, we're still not even close to the resolution of any of these battles, you know? So there was just no way to fit it. That's very true. And then you could make the... Well, he should have cut this, and he should have cut that, and he should have cut things to make room for it. And I'm like, eh... You know, my attitude is that I want to wander and wallow in this world.
Me too.
So if you can eventually include this stuff without cutting anything, that's fine with me. Alyssa Rosenberg makes the argument that certain writers become too big to edit. And I think that's absolutely true. With other writers, I think J.K. Rowling needed an editor very, very badly with those last few Harry Potter volumes, particularly the ending, which I think is just inexcusable. I think Stephen King with the Dark Tower books, you know, like, it's wonderful that you believe you're receiving these words as transmissions from, like, the ether, but we have to read them, man. And it's not working. But in Martin's case, the sprawl is part of what compels me about the series, so it doesn't bother me. And as he always points out, eventually you're not going to have to wait years for the next book. People are just going to sit down and read them all in a row, because they'll all be done, God willing. And then it won't matter as much. You know, and the final thing I would say is that, who knows, maybe the experience of reading The Winds of Winter will be so awesome because it's going to start with climaxes and then do God knows what after that. That everyone will forgive and forget how Dance panned out.
Yeah, that's what I expect anyway.
Yeah.
No matter how Winds of Winter will turn out, people will forget about the Dance problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, before Dance came out, A Feast for Crows was an abomination to many. And then Dance came out, and now Dance was so horrible. I guess they said the same about A Storm of Swords.
Right. Well, I will take this opportunity to plug my combined reading order for A Feast for Crows and A Dance of Dragons.
Yeah, please do so. I mean, this is your one truly monumental, thing that everyone should read and which you should be immortalized for. it just makes the damn book so much better.
This is my page in the white book, you know.
Yeah, definitely. Sean T. Collins, he devised a combined reading order
and defeated the Smiling Knight.
Did you think when you wrote it up, did you think it would be so popular?
No, I didn't, because I wrote it up because I was surprised that one didn't exist, at least not in terms of a consensus choice, you know. I mean, there were several, which is basically how I arrived at mine. I kind of looked at what everyone else did and figured out what I thought the best approach would be from there. But I just assumed, you know, the moment I typed it into Google that it would be returned with, like, oh, this is the one that everyone does. And there wasn't one. And somehow this became the consensus choice for people, which is very nice and very flattering. But no, I never in a million years did I assume, you know, like I have a saved Twitter search on, from boiledleather.com just to see if anyone's linking to any posts that I put up. And 9 times out of 10, it's people I don't know at all saying, like, oh, here's the one I found, you know, in response to someone being like, man, I really wish there were a way to read Feast and Dance together. You know, complete strangers from God knows where. And so it's nice to be a resource, you know, and I always kind of aspired to that. You know, when I think of what the Westeros, you know, what Linda and Elio achieved with Westeros, or what the Tower of the Hand guys did, or what the people at Winter is Coming did, like, this is my one very specific and very small entry into that field, where I feel like I've provided some kind of resource for fandom that will exist independently of me, and that's really nice.
Strange how it turns out. You write so much stuff, and something of it gets total prominence, and other things don't.
Yep, that's very true. But it all, you know, it all works out. So
is that a note to end the podcast?
Yes. This is the most optimistic ending that we've ever had on this stupid show. Well,
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening to yet another installment of the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. And hopefully, you know, in the months to come, there'll be a lot to talk about. The new season's coming out, obviously. You know, we have a release date for The World of Ice and Fire. We have further news about Fire and Blood, the GRM Marillion. We have, you know, a new novella about Prince Daemon coming out in Rogues, the new Gardner Dozois, George R. R. Martin anthology. So there ought to be plenty to talk about, and I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. So thanks for listening, as always, and hopefully we will see us much sooner than from the last time. So
woohoo.
Take care.
Bye-bye.